So as we know, patients with multiple tumors can be really challenging to differentiate between multiple primaries and intrapulmonary metastasis. Currently, morphology is the main method for differentiating between multiple primaries and intrapulmonary mets. However, there is a significant inter-observer variability and imperfect concordance with genomic testing. Driver mutations such as EGFR, KRAS, and BRAF, as well as structural rearrangements, are often not reliable due to field cancerization and other structural changes, as well as the fact that many tumors won't have an identifiable driver mutation. This paper describes the use of somatic DNA junction breakpoints as a precise marker of tumor identity due to their unique specificity. So in terms of the method, they used frozen tissue from 76 tumors from 37 different patients, and all cases had blinded independent clinical and pathologic review. DNA extraction, laser capture, microdissection, whole genome amplification was done. And I want to talk a little bit about the mate pair sequencing analysis. So I put together a little figure there. So the mate pair sequencing requires long fragments of DNA, usually on the order of 3 kb, which is substantially longer than the fragments used for traditional next-generation sequencing assays. And this is the reason why it requires the fresh frozen tissue currently and not the formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue. So what happens is these long DNA fragments are biosecreted and circularized, and then this circularized DNA can then be fragmented, and then you can enrich for these biotin fragments. And then what they do is you can sequence it from both ends. And what you're looking for is fragments that sequence from either end that are 30 kbs apart or mapped to different chromosomes, as you can see in this example with the 512 rearrangement there. And then they filter off germline variants, and then you pick up these somatic junctions that were identified. And then you can compare these between tumors to find if that they have overlapping or non-overlapping. And so this paper defined independent tumors as tumors that had zero overlapping junctions and greater than two non-overlapping junctions. This technique allows for a fine resolution of the somatic breakpoints such that the chance of having two tumors having the exact breakpoints would be on the order of 1 in 10 to the power of 12. So in terms of the results, for the 41 tumor comparisons, the histologic review called 59% independent primaries, 24% metastasis, and 17% indeterminates. And the approach utilized the criteria by Gerard et al., which utilized a stepwise algorithm based on histologic type, subtype, subtype percentages, and then cytological and stromal features to differentiate between independent and metastatic tumors. In terms of the genomic somatic breakpoint approach, that called 73% of cases independent primaries, 27% metastasis, and 0 were called indeterminate. So there was concordance between genomics and histology in 78% of cases. In terms of the discordant cases, it largely involved the indeterminate cases. So based on genomics, these indeterminate cases that were called in histology were now called metastasis in 7% of cases and independent in 10% of cases. And also, 5% of cases that were initially called metastasis on histology were called independent based on the genomics. In terms of the copy number variation, it was concordant in 66% of cases with the genomics, disconcordant in 7, and indeterminate in 27%. 17 of the cases were sequenced with NGS, and then the majority of cases had no driver mutation identified in 53% of cases, and 2 cases that were called independent by the genomic assay had identical KRAS mutations. The clinical inference disagreed with the histology or genomics call in 20% of cases, and there was full concordance between the clinical review of histology and genomics in 63% of cases. So putting it together, the detection of chromosomal rearrangements is a useful and definitive technique in determining lineage for multifocal lung cancer. While it's accurate and definitive, it requires frozen tissue currently, and it's limited by cost and availability of testing.
Do you have any questions to it?
You know, I have a question. As an intellectual exercise, I think this is clearly the best way so far, but when would you use that practically? When do you really need to know?
Well, they would probably be treating them slightly differently if it was one or the other, but...
But treatment is not... let's assume there's just two masses and they're both resected. Then whether you stage one as a met or as two separate primaries, it doesn't make that much difference if there's no other evidence of disease. And in terms of management, you're going to use just the standard stuff we do these days to look for specific drug treatment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I can't speak to why the oncologist would see this. I don't know if anyone else can.
Paging. So, you know, independent T1 or T2 versus if it's in the different lobe, that will be T4. Or if it is in the same lobe and the T3, so that may just lead to slightly different.
I'm assuming if they're both resected, then, you know, I think you go back to Marie-Christine's paper about whether it's, I mean, that's in the same lobe. But if they're both resected and you call it stage 4, I suppose they might treat that one differently, even if there's no evidence of disease. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, so I think staging is the only thing. If it comes out, then I guess nothing else to do if, you know, nothing, if the node dissection and all other things are done. But I'm not sure, you know, they may add a chemo, you know, if that's the same tumor as regarded as a MET, you know, versus two different independent tumor, they may not do anything, you know. So I guess that may be the point.
The most usefulness might be before they resect it and making the decision before in terms of what they're going to do. So sometimes patients may be borderline whether or not to resect. If they knew they were independent primary, our surgeons might be a little more aggressive in trying to maybe resect both versus if they know from the get-go their metastatic disease.
But that presumes so that you've frozen tissue at the time of diagnosis.
For this test, yes, although we have a version that is being developed using paraffin. So down the road, there's other ways we could do it on cytology specimens very well. So just on touch prep, this method exactly like that can be done. And my colleague is working on another method for paraffin. And then the test itself, its true value is not, I agree with you, is not necessarily just for lung tumors, but this is tumor agnostic as a method. So down the road, if ever, especially if we have it working on paraffin, which is our hope, it applies to any tumor. So if you have a lung mass and sometimes we're like, oh, is it a primary? A new primary, is it a metastasis from another site, and you're not too sure even by morphologic comparison, well, this would be applicable. It would apply in any organ. Is it a synchronous endometrial or ovarian cancer or two independent tumors? So there's other situations that it may matter most, and this test has the beauty of being completely tumor agnostic because it just looks for rearrangements of any kind.
Yeah, I think that's actually a potentially more useful thing.
Yeah.
Because in the case of a lung cancer, if there's two primaries and no evidence of metastatic disease, would you really deny that person the opportunity of having both resected for cure based on a molecular test?
That question I don't know the answer to. Yeah.
Yeah, you bring up an important point, Tom. I'm just looking at the NCCN guidelines here, and it does say even if it's a separate pulmonary nodule, T3 or T4 in different lobes, even if the margins are negative and the nodes are negative, apparently they do recommend chemotherapy for adjuvant treatment.
So another question, MC, I was actually wondering, I know you make a point in the paper that this was done on whole tissue sections, and it's questionable whether it works on biopsies or not, but in your experience, since you brought it up, that it might be even more important pre-surgically, would it work in biopsies adequately?
It does. It does work on biopsies because there is a method by which you don't need to, you could amplify in situ. We actually are able to do it on touch prep. So yeah, touch stress from cytology. So that paper is going to be coming out. We just submitted it where just by doing touch prep on biopsies, we were able to do the same method. So technically it could be done even on cytology specimens.
Now that would be nice.
Yep. It would be.
Any other questions to the paper? All right, then let's take it away for the second one.
Great, thanks. The second paper is by Ali et al. It's entitled Spread Through Airspaces, Status is Prognostic in Atypical Carcinoid, Large Cell Neuroendocrine Carcinoma, Small Cell Carcinoma of the Lung, and was also published in Journal of Thoracic Oncology. And the paper was from Dr. Travis's group at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So as we know, spread through airspaces or STAS has been recently shown by numerous groups to have prognostic significance in lung adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and pleomorphic carcinoma, as well as portending a worse outcome in sublobar resections. So in neuroendocrine tumors of lung, there is some prognostic heterogeneity within the defined subtypes, and there are limited prognostic markers to further classify the risk of recurrence and death. So this study was a retrospective study from a single institution that reviewed a series of neuroendocrine tumors that were surgically resected between 1992 and 2012. The cohort included 487 consecutive patients, 299 were typical carcinoid, 38 were atypical carcinoid, 93 were large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, and 57 were small cell. Cases with positive margins or inadequate tissue were excluded. And they defined STAS as tumor cells within air spaces beyond the edge of the main tumor. In all the cases, STAS was in the form of stolid nests, which they show in figure one. And for STAS to be called, they required that more than one tumor cell nest with involvement of at least one airspace beyond the tumor and continuous alveolar spread from the tumor edge to the furthest STAS. And they distinguished it from artifacts, and specifically mechanically dissociated tumor floaters, which they said had ragged edge clusters, random situation in the tissue, located at the edge of the section or appearance out of the plane, as well as normal benign pneumocytes, strips of tumor cells that were dissociated, and isolated tumor cells, clusters that were distant away. The endpoints were recurrence and lung cancer-specific death. Important to note, they excluded the typical carcinoids from the analysis because there was only four recurrences and two lung cancer-specific deaths. So they didn't do any prognostic analysis on those cases. So in terms of results, STAS was higher, incidence of STAS was overall 26% and higher in higher grade tumors. So while it was only 16% in typical carcinoid, it went up to 37% in atypical, 43% in large cell neuroendocrine, and 46% in small cell. It was associated with a higher end stage in LBI in typical carcinoid, higher KSK7 in atypical carcinoid, and higher mitotic count in large cell neuroendocrine. So I've summarized in Table 5, which you can take a look at for your in on your own there, but that shows the cumulative incidence of recurrence and the 5-year lung cancer specific incidence of death. And you can see that it's higher in cases with STAS in the overall group, as well as in large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma and small cell carcinoma. The 5-year lung cancer specific death wasn't any significant difference in the atypical carcinoid. But all groups, including the overall, also had higher rates of recurrence in the STAS-positive group. They also did some multivariate analysis, and STAS was independently associated with higher risk of recurrence in atypical carcinoid, small cell, and as well as large cell. And it was also associated with lung cancer-specific death. And then in the subgroup analysis, STAS was also independently associated with lung cancer-specific death for the small cell group, as well as the large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So inclusion STAS associated with increased recurrence and cancer-specific death in patients with atypical carcinoid, large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, and small cell, and as well as independently associated with lung cancer-specific death in the large cell and small cell. So take-home message is STAS is common in neuroendocrine tumors, and patients with higher grade neuroendocrine tumors may have worse outcomes if STAS is present. I also wanted to point out that one of the papers for notation, Altany et al., published in Virchow's, also reported STAS and atypical carcinoids and found a similar worse outcome in patients with STAS.
Thank you, Matt. Do you have any questions for the paper? Matt, did they talk about the typical carcinoid tumors? I know you mentioned there are 16% of STAS in the typical carcinoids, but then it never appears in relationship to overall survival also?
Yeah, so they excluded them from the analysis because there were so few recurrences that they didn't include it in any of the prognostication. So there wasn't enough events to calculate any outcomes. But it was associated with, I think, LVI and end stage in the typical carcinoid.
Okay. So is any of you, I was just curious, are you reporting stas in your resection specimens or not?
No, but this is Henry. I'm glad to see that they at least have photos of what they considered stas as opposed to artifact, because I don't follow this. There's a lot of papers that have come out, and I've certainly not read all of them, but I don't know that I've seen images like this previously where they try to show you the distinction.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
I thought stas was recommended. I'm not doing resections anymore, but I thought stas was recommended now to mention.
Well, it's in the CAP template. It's in the CAP template.
Yeah, we left. There was a very hotly debated point at the time of publication of that, and we left it, at least I believe it's still optional because the more data has come out since then. But I don't know, Anya, I heard through the grapevine at the last pulmonary panel meeting at the IASLC that this was an extremely hotly debated topic, and because so many of the studies have been published under one author's institution, that there was a lot of pushback, and I don't know if you were at that meeting and can speak to any of that.
Right. I mean, this debate is still going on. I mean, I think the bigger front is that stas is real, although there are still people who argue that stas is all artificial, but they really can't get around the point that there is prognostic significance to whether you believe it is real or artificial or not. And there is actually now a sub-working group formed in the pathology committee of the IASLC that really will deal with stas, what is out in the literature. And it's actually published now from several groups, not only one. And so hopefully by the next meeting, we come to a consensus. I mean, looking through these articles that are out there actually is interesting because there are also different definitions and people look at different aspects. And so it's really hard to compare all these studies. But I think we might be at least coming closer in the regards to that stas is likely real. And in the end, probably the clinicians really want to know about it.
Hey, Kelly, are you reporting stas? This is Brandon.
I would say that, you know, obviously I don't see as many resections as these major places, but I've only actually seen it a handful of times. And I guess the short answer is I've grudgingly reported it when I think it's really, you know, really obvious, but not cases that I think are questionable is the short answer. But again, the whole, and I understand the issue of that it often goes with cases that have a micropapillary component in them, and that some of these nuanced studies have shown that it's even independent of micropapillary. But it is really curious that you mostly see it, of course, in things that have a micropapillary pattern.
I mean, the other question would be, how do you ever will report, or how do you ever will be able to report it at the frozen section lab? Because, I mean, I'm a little concerned that in some of these small tumors that they do segmentectomies, and then they really want to know if there's stas or not, because then they might go to lobectomy. And so that will be, I think, a problem.
Has anybody actually gone back and looked at original frozen sections to see if it's there in cases that have it?
I would have to check that paper, but I believe there was a paper in Histopathology a couple of years ago that looked at, in general, at frozen section for AIS and MIA, and I think they looked into into stas, but I can't recollect the details of it. But I agree, it seems like in the pathology community are setting themselves up potentially for unreasonable expectations at frozen section, and it would be nice if a large center published something else on what is feasible and reasonable at frozen section.
Yeah, there was we could only find one paper that looked at staff in at the frozen section, and their conclusion was that you can't really reproduce it properly and that it was too early. But that was the only study we could find done at the frozen section, specifically looking at the frozen section.
No, I was thinking about you've got the resection, you know there's staff there or not, and then if you can go back,
oh,
what
and going
the correlation
back.
Is.
Yeah. We might actually venture down that road and try it.
That's the high
because
road or the low road.
I know. We have one surgeon who's really adamant about wanting to know it at the time of frozen, and we're like, we'll see if we can get some answers.
All right. If there are no other comments, we'll go to the next topic, and I chose that it's about atypical carcinoids and large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas, and I chose that for also a reason that there is more, I think there are more publications out there now about neuroendocrine tumors, and there's also some debate on where we should go with neuroendocrine tumors and whether or not there might be new biomarkers that help us clinically with these patients. So this case or this paper is from Verona, Italy, and also includes a couple of other centers in Italy. The lead author, Simbolo, and entitled Gene Expression Profiling of Lung Atypical Carcinoids and Large Cell Neuroendocrine Carcinomas, identifies three transcriptomic subtypes with specific genomic alterations. The paper was also published in JTO. So there is some evidence that atypical carcinoids and large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas share some molecular alterations, but these two groups have not been directly compared in that regard. We know that some molecular alterations are found in all groups of pulmonary neuroendocrine tumors, so including the typical and atypical carcinoids, the small cell carcinomas, and the large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas. But then there are other genes that have alterations only, for instance, in the carcinoids, so including the ME1 gene alterations. And then the inactivation of TP53 and RB1 is predominantly found in the carcinomas. In addition, there appear to be some variations in frequencies of some of the same gene alterations in between carcinoids and carcinomas, which may be suggestive of the possibility of progression of malignancy or a development of secondary high-grade neuroendocrine carcinoma from a pre-existing carcinoid. So in this paper, they included 35 atypical carcinoids and 32 large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas. They were all surgically resected and did not have any preoperative therapy. They had a discovery set of 28 cases and a validation set of the remaining cases, and they used custom gene panels. So in total, there were 67 patients. Interestingly, half of these patients were stage 1, and that was followed by stage 2 and a few in stage 3 and 4. In the discovery set, they performed hierarchical unsupervised clustering analysis and actually were able to put these cases into four clusters. Cluster 1 pretty much only included large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas. Cluster 2 only included atypical carcinoids. Cluster 3 was pretty much a mixture of atypical carcinoids and large cell neuroendocrine tumors. And 4 were their control cases, the non-neoplastic lung. In the discovery set, they also identified 58 genes that were differentially expressed between these three tumor clusters. And then in the table, you see the results of all. So the discovery and the validation set combined. And if you look at cluster 1, it still is only or almost only comprised of large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas. There's only one atypical carcinoid. All of these tumors had inactivation of RB and inactivation of TP53. None of them had MEN1 mutation. This group had the highest Ki-67 labeling index and the shortest cancer-specific survival. Now, if we look at cluster 3, this had mainly atypical carcinoids. None of the tumors had inactivation of RB. Only about 17% had inactivation of TP53, and this group had the highest percentage of cases with MEN mutation.
Are you guys feeling fatigued?
Yes.
What's going on? Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, let's proceed.
All right, so we were at cluster 3, and that cluster had the lowest Ki-67, and the cancer-specific survival was not reached at the time. And then looking at cluster 2 is really a mixture of large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas and atypical carcinoids, and everything is in between cluster 1 and 3. They had a few inactivation of RB. Half of the cases about had an inactivation of TP53, some MEN1 mutations, and the Ki-67 labeling index was in the middle. They actually then subclustered cluster 2 and found cluster 2A, which was closer to cluster 1 with a high Ki-67, and cluster 2B was closer to cluster 3 with only atypical carcinoid tumors and a low Ki-67. So basically, if we look at atypical carcinoids and large cell neuroendocrine tumors as a group, there seem to be three different clinically relevant molecular diseases. So one is enriched by large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas with RB1 inactivation. One is enriched by atypical carcinoids where MEN1 mutations seem to play a major role. And then there is this mixed group. And the authors actually suggested that their findings were at least supporting that a proportion of atypical carcinoids might progress to large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas. Any questions to that?
So that the cluster 3, that where there are mixed the AC and the large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, or the morphology, I mean, like a mitotic count or necrosis, that kind of thing in large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma was at the low end. You know, we talked about at the last last journal club by Jan Boland on the carcinoid paper where there's like grade 3 carcinoid tumor, maybe that's technically large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, but they were kind of different from the regular small cell and large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma behaviors, remember?
Right. That's a great question. And they did not go into that. They only went into the Ki-67. So the cluster 3 was mainly atypical carcinoids, and they had the lowest Ki-67, but they did not talk about how they differentiated between or in regards to mitosis and necrosis, because they used those two things to differentiate between atypical carcinoid and large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. Somewhere they said that the large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas had much more necrosis and had a much higher mitotic count. I think it was around 60 to 70 of a mean, but they never really discussed it in between the or amongst the clusters. That's a good question. Any other questions? All right. Then the next paper is a lung transplant paper, and actually I chose this paper because there is some talk about now telomerase shortening and its association with pulmonary fibrosis. And so this paper is by Duke, authors from Duke, and the lead author is Swaminathan. entitled Lung Transplant Outcomes in Patients with Pulmonary Fibrosis with Telomere-Related Gene Variants. This was published in CHEST. And basically, telomeres are to protect the chromosome ends from shortening during cell replication, and the telomerase is an enzyme that catalyzes the addition of telomeres, so basically preventing the shortening of the telomeres. We also know that short telomeres are actually associated with bone marrow failures, premature aging, with cancer, and actually also early death. And it has been found that variants in telomere-related genes, so some of them are actually with telomerase-associated genes, including TERT, TERC, RTL1, and PARN, are associated with familial pulmonary fibrosis, and some of these variants are also associated with an increased risk for sporadic pulmonary fibrosis. Now, the Duke team previously had genotyped 262 pulmonary fibrosis lung transplant recipients by whole exome sequencing, and they used this population for this paper. They also calculated the acute rejection burden during the first post-transplant year, and the definition was the sum of ISHLT grade A or B scores divided by the total number of transbronchial biopsies with a gradable rejection. So amongst these 262 patients, 31 actually did have rare variants in TERT, RTL1, or PARN, but none of them had clinically a systemic telomere syndrome before the transplantation. The demographics were very similar between the group with pulmonary fibrosis with the variants and the group with pulmonary fibrosis without the variants. Now, post-transplant, the group with the variants had more commonly anemia, but there was no difference in the acute rejection burden or any rate of grade 3 primary graft dysfunction between these groups post-transplant. Now, you may know the chronic lung allograft dysfunction is now subtyped into the obstructive and the restrictive group, and amongst the patients with CLAD obstructive group or CLAD-BOS, actually more of the patients without the variants developed CLAD-BOS than patients with the variants. But if we look at the restrictive CLAD, more patients with the variants actually developed the restrictive CLAD in comparison to the patients without the variants. And now from now on, they do not distinguish between restrictive and obstructive CLAD anymore. They only talk about CLAD. So they say that the onset of CLAD is shorter in the patients with the variants, and that the presence of these variants is actually an independent predictor for CLAD after they adjusted for age at transplant, type of transplant, sex, primary graft dysfunction, and acute rejection score. They followed the patients over a median of 2.8 years, and actually more patients with the variants died than patients without the variants. And they found that patients with pulmonary fibrosis with these variants have a higher risk of death than those patients without the variants. And the presence of the variants had a higher risk of death also after adjusting for age, sex, and type of transplant. And in fact, the leading cause of death in the patients with the variants was CLAD. So as take-home points, these variants in telomere-related genes are associated or appear to be associated with poor post-transplant outcomes among pulmonary fibrosis lung transplant recipients, and that was independent of the other known factors that are usually associated with worse outcome, such as age and the type of transplant. I mean, I don't think we know anything about the etiology why these patients do have a worse outcome, because there was no difference in the acute rejection score or the primary graft dysfunction or CMV infection or any of these factors they looked at. Interestingly, they did not look into the comparison of patients that had shortened telomeres by itself, because there are probably some other mutations that also lead to shortened telomeres. So I'm not sure if they really captured all the patients with shortened telomeres or not. But yes, they had a couple of hypotheses why these patients with the variants might have a worse outcome than the other patients. It had something to do with maybe increased immunosuppression in the variants or some alveolar stem cell senescence that might occur because of donor alveolar epithelial cells. Any questions?
Yeah, just a sort of does anybody know how many transplants Duke does? This is a huge number of cases.
I don't know, but I think they do many more than what we do. Yeah, I agree.
And they're all you know, pulmonary fibrosis cases. In their materials and methods, they don't give the time that they were identified, when they're from.
That is a good question. I don't think so. I don't think I read it because this was from the previous paper, and I don't have that paper here, so I would have to look that up. But that's a great question, yeah. I know that our transplant patients now actually do undergo the testing for short telomeres, and I know they do that because I think they get then they evaluate the bone marrow frequently because these patients do get earlier bone marrow failures. But in the pulmonary fibrosis patients without transplant, I'm not sure if they all get tested currently or not.
Just in regard to Tom's question, according to Duke's website, since 1992, they've performed more than 2,000 lung transplants, and in 2018, they performed 107.
Wow.
Right. That is way more. Amazing. Yeah. All right. Any other questions to that one? And we'll get to the last one. This one I actually put in for more practical purposes. It's about ZB2, and we currently develop ZB2 in our Immunostains lab, and I know some people, I mean, also outside of Mayo, are very excited about it because of its value apparently for diagnosing the colorectal adenocarcinomas. But according to this paper, well, we'll see. So it's the lead author is Bradfield from the University of New Mexico, and that was a collaboration with Cleveland Clinic. It's entitled ZB2 versus CDX2, a battle royale for diagnostic supremacy in mucinous tumors, published in the archives. And, I mean, we all know that metastatic mucinous tumors, it's often very difficult to identify the primary site if we just use immunostains because, at least I find that they're always positive for CK7, CK20, and a little bit of CDX2. And then we still don't know where they are coming from. So recently, ZB2, or the special AT-rich sequence binding protein 2, had been identified as a marker of glandular epithelium of the lower GI tract, and they make a point including the appendix, and is used as a marker of metastatic mucinous colorectal carcinoma when they compared it to ovarian mucinous neoplasms. However, if you just look at the sensitivity of ZB2, comparing mucinous colorectal carcinomas versus non-mucinous colorectal carcinomas, even there, ZB2 has a lower sensitivity for the mucinous colorectal carcinomas. Now, the study was to compare expression of ZB2 and CDX2 between mucinous tumors of various origins. So they included all primary mucinous epithelial tumors they could identify, and as a definition, they needed to have more than 50% of a mucinous component. They used whole tissue sections, including 44 mucinous colorectal carcinomas and 175 non-colorectal mucinous tumors, including coming from the ovary, the breast, lung, uterus, pancreas, and stomach and esophagus. Now, for the ZB2, there are multiple clones out there, and I think there's also a polyclonal. They used here the clone EP281, and for CDX2, they also used a monoclonal antibody, and they looked for nuclear staining. The scoring was done by intensity, 0 through 3+, and then they gave a score according to the percent of tumor cell nuclei staining. Score 0 was if less than 5% of tumor cells stained, score 1 was 5 to 49% of tumor cell staining, and a score 2 was over or equal to 50% of tumor cell staining, and the H score was then the sum of intensity and percent staining score. Now, for the SAT-B2, the accuracy was over 90% for colorectal mucinous carcinomas at low to moderate expression levels. For CDX2, an overall accuracy of 89% for colorectal mucinous adenocarcinomas was only reached if the H score was 5 or higher. That means if there was strong expression in a lot of the cells. Now, they've gone about these H scores, and it's getting a little cumbersome there, but I thought I just wanted to look at the lung, and so I put that all into a table, and if you just look at the lung, I think SAT-B2 seems to be very nice to differentiate between the lung mucinous adenocarcinomas and the colorectal mucinous adenocarcinomas, because in the lungs, none of them stain for SAT-B2, and basically all of the colorectal adenocarcinomas stained for SAT-B2. I think there's one case that has less than 5% of tumor cell staining, but looking at the intensity, they were almost all positive. Now, this is not true for CDX2. CDX2 is all over the place in the lung and in the colorectum. So I think SAT-B2 might be useful for the distinction of lung from colorectal origin, and they actually had very similar findings for the pancreatic mucinous adenocarcinomas. They were also all negative. But since it seems that not all 100% of colorectal carcinomas stain for SAT-B2, I still think we need clinical pathological correlation in the end. So that is the spiel here on SAT-B2. I don't know if any of you uses that antibody. Anyone has any experience with that? I take that as a no. We'll see what our experience is with that antibody. So we just have a few minutes left. I just wanted to share a few or just point out a few articles. One is on DLL3. You might remember DLL3 was a big topic maybe a year ago because it seemed to be, at least in animal studies and phase one trials, a nice antibody or targeted therapy for small cell carcinomas. Unfortunately, it turned out that it was highly toxic, so I think they stopped these trials, and I haven't heard about DLL3 since. Then another paper is on MET immunohistochemistry, that this is really not a good mean to screen for MET amplification or MET exon 14. And then on page 13, there is a study on lung cancers associated with cystic airspaces, and I found that very interesting because it does not seem to be an issue for pathology, but it seems to be an issue for radiologists, because in one of these CT screening studies, about 22% of these lung cancers, when they were associated with cystic airspaces, were actually missed. So I found that quite interesting. Then there's another study which is just dealing with small lung adenocarcinoma resections, and even if they just show contrast opacities on CT scans, they still can have invasion and they still can have staph. And then there was a case series on lung tumors with trophoblastic morphology and how you actually distinguish whether this is a lung carcinoma with some trophoblastic differentiation or whether that is a metastasis from a germ cell tumor or a true trophoblastic tumor after a pregnancy. So with that, thank you very much for your participation. I really appreciate it, and I wish you a nice day.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Anya.